Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Woodzik, and my pronouns are they, them, and theirs. This is episode 161 with Mark and Margaret Fairbanks. Mark and Margaret are the co-founders of Islands of Brilliance, which is a Milwaukee-based nonprofit that has been creating really unique, progressive, affirming programming for autistic and neurodivergent individuals like myself for the past 11 years. So we dig deep into their story, the why behind the organization, but then we also go back further, exploring their roots in the theater industry and how that really set them up for success in creating social impact programming. To quote Addams Family, the musical, full disclosure, I am an employee of Islands of Brilliance. I'm proud to be their statewide outreach manager. And I hope you take away two things from this podcast. One, theater artists are uniquely positioned to create social impact programming. It's really a juicy connection. And so if you have that idea on the back burner of, oh, I really think that this would be neat and this would be of service to this group of folks, I hope that this podcast galvanizes you to move that idea into action. And then the second thing I hope you take away and really take to heart is the conversation we have about joy and creating joy. And there's a distinction between joy and happiness. We don't get into in the podcast, but I'll leave it here. Joy is a moment, right? Joy is a spark, a lightning bolt, a moment, whereas happiness is a practice. So especially if you're struggling with executive function, it's easier to create and experience joy than happiness. So I hope you go out in the world today and find some joy. This April, when this podcast is going live, is, depending on who you talk to, Autism Acceptance Awareness Action Month. And so I hope you're spending some time online seeing what autistic and neurodivergent theater makers are putting out there. And as always, I hope that you support their work and, you know, invite them, include them in your theater projects moving forward. So that was a longer intro than normal, but I hope you sit back, relax, and enjoy episode 161 with Mark and Margaret Fairbanks. I am thrilled to welcome to the podcast Mark and Margaret Fairbanks, the co-founders of Islands of Brilliance and former theater kids. Welcome to the podcast, y'all!
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Woodzik.
All right. So for those of you who are, for those who are unfamiliar with your work, what is your sort of elevator pitch introduction to yourself and Islands of Brilliance? We'll get more into the work in more depth later on in our conversation, but to front load it right now, what would you say?
I'm going to say, go ahead, Mark.
All right. We are parents of an adult son with autism, Harry. He's now 25. He was identified just before the age of three. And Islands of Brilliance really came out of our learnings in raising him of what connected and worked with him. So in our Islands of Brilliance workshops, which involve imagination, creativity, what we call creative technology, so things like iPads and Photoshop and Illustrator, we allow our students and empower them to explore their special interests, or spin, as we call it. And what do we mean by that? So often neurodivergent individuals or autistic individuals have things that they are very passionate about. In the case of Harry, it was trains. So it might be trains or transportation related things. It might be media, if you think in terms of Pokemon or anime or Marvel Universe. It might be video games, you know, Fortnite, Five Nights at Freddy's, things like that. So we allow them to take that subject matter expertise and create through that. And what happens is something very magical that produces a lot of joy, in that it puts them in the situation that they are the subject matter expert. They are the creator. They are the driver of the projects. And all the things that we know from whether it's theater or arts and things like that boost things like self-confidence, self-advocacy, collaborative skills, workforce readiness skills. So Islands of Brilliance has been this wonderful journey that Margaret and I started the organization, and it has grown, now spreading across the state of Wisconsin, as you very well know.
See, I could never say that as succinctly as he does. That's why I always let him do this.
I hope that was
And
the same.
so your roles respectively are, you're both co-founders, and Mark, you are the CE executive director or CEO? Remind me. My mind is blanking right now.
Executive director.
There you go.
I am technically the CEO, but it's the chief education officer.
You
So,
go. That's why my mind got,
yeah.
that's why the wires were crossed. So
That was a trick there.
I am fascinated by folks who are longtime collaborators, and y'all have collaborated together for decades. And so I'm wondering, how did you two meet initially?
Okay, well, this is a good story. This is one I will jump into. So, quite frankly, he was dating my roommate.
All right. Okay.
And when that didn't work out, we just started hanging out together. Actually, we were all hanging out together because we were all in the theater department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, the Peck School of the Arts. So, theater people hang out together. So we were all hanging out together. He and Lindsay started dating. That kind of fizzled, but we really enjoyed hanging out together. And honestly, we were just really good friends before we're like, there's something to this. But theater was sort of the thing that brought us together because we did, as you'll learn, we did a lot of shows together. We took had a lot of classes together. You kind of end up hanging out in the same area, so that really was a uniting factor for us.
We actually spent a lot of time at the Gast House in the UWM Union after rehearsals, either playing backgammon or cards or things like that, and just, enjoyed that time together. And here we are, whatever, 4 years later.
I love that. I think you were talking earlier, Mark, about spins, and theater has absolutely been a special interest of mine for many years. And I think there's something delicious for a neuro divergent brain about theater, because it's like really intense, but it's siloed into like a 2 or 3 month experience. Do you want to like shout out any other things? I love Hannah Gadsby's TED Talk, where they talk about like, it might not make sense for an autistic person to be a stand-up comedian, but actually, like, the rules are very in place. I'm in charge. I'm driving the bus. Are there any other insights from your time in theater where you're like, yeah, this is why theater's friendly for like a neurodivergent brain?
What I like about the way I look at it is that the role is defined. The role is very clear, right? You
Right.
have a script, you have a description, you have a through line, you have a beginning, middle, and an end, right? Whereas life itself can be nebulous. So understanding that I'm stepping into this role, I understand the through line of this role, there's clear defined interactions that I can explore, as opposed to I might not understand what your face is telling me. It's a little bit different with theater because you basically, even though the audience is not supposed to know that, you know as an actor what the outcome is, even though you try to play in the moment. So I think as far as being, neurodiverse, it is a place where you can step outside of that thing that might be you and that might make you feel for lack of a better word, you might not be comfortable with just face-to-face interactions because it's unpredictable. With theater, it is predictable. You know what to expect and you've rehearsed it. So it is definitely, like you said, that sort of understood environment where there's, nothing's nebulous.
I think too, it's what we brought from our theatrical backgrounds to Islands of Brilliance. Margaret, had a much longer, I guess, career stint in doing theater and on-camera work and things like that. Mine was kind of confined to high school, college, and after college years. But I think what we look at is we've always referred to our workshops as the show. And I think if you look at our workshops, the way that they're structured, it's very much structured like a theatrical endeavor. There's the prelude, and then there's kind of the main story, and then there's always presentations too. So we are encouraging students at the end of our workshops to stand and present and be celebrated. You know all about that. And the way that they choose to celebrate is often very fun and theatrical and dramatic. And I think that aspect of theater and improv, things don't always go according to script with neurodivergent individuals. And the ability to kind of play the scene and surf and things like that, all those kind of foundational core qualities of being on stage are really, baked into the IOB experience.
And I want to build on that, yes, and I keep saying I became a special ed teacher, and more than any other skill, I use my improv. Because if I am not connecting with that student in the same way that I'm not connecting with my audience, my student is my audience. If they're not listening to me, it's not their fault. It's my fault. And that is often what you see in classrooms. It's like, oh, that child is doing this on purpose. They're, as opposed to what can I do differently? So when I go, when I became a special ed teacher, I was like, it is on me to figure out how that person learns and interacts. And I have to change my script to reach them. And that is something that we did initially with Harry. We changed the way we interacted with him to get him to engage, to pay attention. I brought that into my teaching, and then clearly, as Mark shared, that is a huge piece of why Islands works. We change our script all the time to listen to that person and understand what they're trying to tell us.
Oh, this conversation makes me very, very happy. All the good feels. All the good feels. Let's pivot now and do a little bit of a James Lipton inside the actor's studio. I asked you to share a couple of memorable theatrical experiences. So we're going big. These are all very like mythological, huge pieces. So tell me about the Bacchae.
The Bacchae was a very intense experience. So at the time, both Mark and I were participating in the in a show in collaboration with the PTP, so the Professional Actors Training Program at UWM. It was a phenomenal, for those of you who know theater training programs, it was, again, one of the best in the country. And Tadashi Suzuki and some of his team, some of his troupe came to the United States, and we worked for months. I mean, we had to learn the techniques. We had to march. We had to, I mean, it was physically intense because everything they did was through the physical, right? You had to become physically the character first before you even walked on stage. So there was what it's about 2 or 3 months of just like marching and, I could even scream at the top of my lungs the song we used to sing. But then also watching his actors and the way they interacted, for us, it was a cultural mind shift. Whoa. Because there was definitely something that we weren't used to seeing in the, in America, right? In the 80s, women, had no, this was he was definitely the way he treated Kyoko Shinichi was stunning to me in some ways, but the way she handled it was so, it was deeper than him, So it was beautiful to see the very interesting interaction between director and actor, actress, but also how that summoned up the best of her in her performance. I mean, it was, she played Dionysus and she was this god on stage. It was truly amazing to see what we, that you could see the years of what she had gone through. We'd done months of it, but when you saw her, you could see how her entire body was ready for this and just summon it up in size. It was really a very wonderful, challenging, exciting experience because it was so different than I think many people get to experience. It wasn't your classical Shakespeare. It wasn't your classical musical theater. It was definitely a whole different cultural phenomena.
I think too, the great thing about the performance, she did her lines in Japanese.
Oh,
So
wow.
you had Tom Hewitt played, was the lead. And, so she was doing the lines and her voice was like this spirit growl in Japanese. And it was just, to be part of that, looking back on it, I think when you're younger, just like, oh, what's this? When you look back on it was, just an amazing experience and just our roles as kind of part of the chorus and these very slow motion physical entrances and stuff like that. It was an amazing thing. And to think that it was at UW Milwaukee and what was that, 1981? Spring of
80s, yeah.
1981 is the one it was. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
I
That's
wish
wild.
I could have seen it. I mean, that was the thing.
Yeah.
It was so visual. And me, because when you only get to see aspects of it because you can like sneak out in the audience, and but to actually see the whole thing visually from the audience perspective really would have been pretty phenomenal.
I just, yeah, in grad school we did a little bit of Suzuki, but then we also had a guest artist come in from the Beijing Opera. And just to any actor, if you get a chance to experience a theatrical practice from another country, please do it. Because I mean, right, like 20 grad students on the floor just doing eye exercises, because in that practice it's like, I mean, and every day, like half an hour of throwing your eyes from one corner to another. It's, I think that we can get very fixated on quote unquote the right way to do theater. And secret is there's not a right way to do theater, right? We have a lot of there's many different cultural perspectives, so check it out, folks. Catacle of the Sun. What is memorable about this production for y'all?
That was fall of 81. That was produced by, I think, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, Catholic Archdiocese. Yeah. And I Googled, I cannot, the playwright and director was from Chicago, and I Googled, and Google failed. And so I can't remember his name, but he came up to direct this show that Margaret and I were cast in. So basically, Canticle of the Sun, SON, unlike SUN, which is the Saint Francis of Assisi story, or I don't know, forget what Canticle of the Sun and song, was the story of Saint Francis and his father, this fraught relationship between the two of them. So Margaret actually played Lady Barbara. Was that his fiance or love? I forget.
They were supposed to have been married in the traditional,
Yes.
you know, and they were betrothed to each other, but didn't work out with,
Didn't
with
work
his
out.
calling.
And I was Francis's best friend Martin, who was kind of sweet on Lady Barbara. So there was a very obnoxious scene where Martin does an unwanted kiss of Lady Barbara,
And then
and
Lady Barbara
Margaret,
gets to do a very loud slap.
and it was for reals.
No
So by then
stage
we were
for that
dating.
there.
So that was kind of fun because I think we got paid a little bit for that and everything, and the Archbishop came, and they were good
Was a
for us, or
long run too. It's a
was
very
yeah.
It was a long show, and so it was, and yes, as Mars mentioned, we were dating by that time, so it was like, you get up, I hope I didn't hurt you, but you're like, yeah, I'm an active man, I'm gonna, you're gonna take it on the chin.
Oh my goodness. I love
Yeah.
it. I love it. And then we're going to close out this actor's studio moment with Electra, a Central American tragedy. So this is where y'all started being like, we want to make some, we want to be driving the car ourselves a little bit. Why this project? What were the ripple effects of this
A
dynamic?
little
This
bit
is
of
the first.
background. So this is a, I will start because after leaving UWM, I was accepted to Boston University to their actor training program. So I uprooted for about a year, moved to Boston. Mark followed me out there, and again found your niche in theater. And because I was in the theater training program, we had I lived theater 24/7 for years. And Mark was kind of left acting, was writing at the time. And of course, when you are 21 years old, you think you can do anything. And, we're like, well, we can put on a show. Hey, Jimmy, let's rent a barn. And it's kind of what we did. I mean, we cobbled together some really amazing, talented young people who were like, yeah, we can do that right alongside with you. And we're gonna bootstrap it. And amazingly, we did. And
It was our first entrepreneurial collaboration together. And as I say, there's, nonprofit experimental theater company. There's nothing more nonprofit than an experimental theater company,
correct.
right? So
I think we
it was
had to
called
do
Labyrinth
a couple
Company.
extra bartending shifts to be able to rent the space, but we did it.
Yeah, we put up the money for it and everything. But the idea was actually pretty cool. It was taking Electra because there are parallels between the classic Electra story and then the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, and so the script or adaptation kind of blended those two things together. And for I don't know how we did this, but we got the theater critic of the Boston Herald, a bunch of 22-year-old kids doing this show. We were nobodies, and they panned it, but it was a like
It
big
was a
article
big
in the
spread.
Boston in the Daily out there. So it was, one of those things that you look back on. 1984, after rehearsals is always a thing. We used to go to this bar in Boston called the Dugout, or we called it the Dujo. It was near Fenway Park. It was during the 84 Olympics, so Mary Lou Retton and all. It's just like you look back and have these wonderful memories of that time and the camaraderie of the troupe, as it were, putting it together. But yeah, that was our first big nonprofit or small nonprofit.
Then we realized it's really hard to do that in a city as expensive as Boston.
Right.
Very much. I might have to dig into the Boston newspaper archives and try to find this. Well, that might be a rabbit hole thing I do tonight. So we're going to say farewell to theater for a little bit in our conversation. Mark, you touched on this a little bit, but can we go deeper into the IOB origin story? Because I think it's a pretty profound story, and it's a shared experience, I think, unfortunately, for a lot of folks.
It sure is. Our story, is mirrored by many families who have an autistic loved one who's in, especially the diagnosis process. So, at the time, we have two boys, Charlie and Harry. Harry's our youngest. And at the time, Margaret was very involved in on camera and voiceover work professionally, commercial. I had gone into marketing and advertising. I was a creative director. So we both maintained these careers that had their foothold in creative process. So Harry, was developing kind of at a normal rate up until about 18 months, and then he started to regress, actually. It was almost like he was the kid we knew was disappearing before our eyes, and so eventually we had him looked at by a neurologist, screened, and the diagnosis was autism. So it was PDD-NOS, so pervasive developmental delay. Is it not one specified?
Not otherwise
Not
specified.
otherwise specified. So it wasn't, we were in line with that. It wasn't the diagnosis, it was the prognosis that they gave him. So he's not even 3 years old, and they literally said he won't be ready for first grade. Don't plan on him going to college. So you can imagine, as a parent, you're already reeling, you're heartbroken, you're scared. What does this mean? How are we gonna deal with this? But then you get that, and it's like, we're just angry. Like, how can you say that about a kid who's not even 3 years old? So I think I was the one, the Sicilian looked at him, and I said, he will be ready for first grade and he'll determine what he's capable of doing. And that was it. And that is an experience that is shared by so many parents. Like, forget about what you expected. Just like, put that away. This is what, and we were left to kind of figure out what the pathway was. And I'm going to pass it at this point, the baton to Margaret, because it was, she talked about the improv skills earlier, and that's really like the first, the first linchpin in like falling in the story of IOB is really Margaret. Saint Margaret of the Fairbanks.
Well, I mean, Mark mentioned that Harry, he lived in a world of trains, right? For him, it was the island of Sodor. And I would watch him and he would interact with these videos. He would interact with the trains, but he wouldn't interact with me or other humans. And we kept hearing from the experts, oh, model the behavior you want to see. Well, he was having none of it, right? But what I could see was that he was engaged on the island of Sodor. So one day I was like, man, like I said, I got to change my script. And I got down on the floor on my hands and knees and I started whistling like a train. Beep, beep, Thomas. And man, he looked at me. He made eye contact with me for the first time in a long time. And it was a moment. It was only a moment. But that told me a lot, right? I have to go to him. He's not going to come to me. I have to go to him. And so fast forward, if he was going to read a book, it had to be a book about trains. If he was going to do math, it was going to be putting trains together and taking them apart. Anything that resonated with him. And again, we were just looking for, improv. You try it, doesn't work, try something else. I mean, way back at that time, fax paper rolled. Way back. You're too young.
There was such a thing as fax paper.
There was fax paper, and it because it kind of looked like a wheel. And you could roll it out and roll it back. That's the way we got him to write. Because he would only write on fax paper because we could roll it out the way a train wheel rolls that way. So then he would start drawing, he would draw trains. And then to get him to actually write, we had to do speech bubbles because the trains would talk to each other. So anything we did was something that meant something to him and he made progress. Even in first grade, I went to visit his school and of course, brought all the books and they're like, well, Harry doesn't read. I'm like, yeah, he does. If it's a Thomas book, and I handed him the Thomas book and he read that to the class, like he was like, in third grade. And they're like, what? I'm like, I told you. He's not going to read Houghton Mifflin, but Thomas the Tank Engine, he's got this. And I'm going to fast forward because basically, Mark, as we said, we fought, let him lead as opposed to us leading. And by letting him lead, he made progress. So as Mark mentioned, he was a creative director. So this is where we kind of introduce that technology piece. Because what I learned very early on is if you use technology, whether it's an Elmo game, and he can spell using Elmo, because that's a safe space. That's not a human face. That's a safe space. And all of a sudden he's spelling. And again, the teachers are like, oh, he can't spell. I'm like, well, yeah, he can if it's Elmo. I'm like, oh, that's just a game. I'm like, well, no, actually, he know. If you gotta trust me on this one, he knows how to spell. And he
Right.
did.
Well, it was his interest too. Like he was driving it. So, we would enroll him in things like Challenger, Little League kind of stuff. But he was not interested in T-ball or stuff like that. But he was consuming media online. So he's on YouTube and he's watching stop motion stuff with Legos. But the fascinating thing is he's posting in the threads. He's carrying on a conversation. So he's about 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old at this point. I'm like, that's fascinating that. For him, like if you read the threads, you wouldn't know he was autistic. But he
Right.
would struggle at school having conversations with his peers. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then the magic, day was I'm working, actually we're out, I'm getting my oil changed. I've got my laptop, working on a Saturday. That's what you do in advertising. And he's watching me make this character in Adobe Illustrator. He says, Dad, that looks like fun. Can I try it? So I said, well, when we get home, I'll show you how. So I set him up. I had a desktop in the basement, like give him 5 minutes of instruction in Illustrator. Here's how you draw a square. Here's how you change the color, stuff like that, basic stuff. And just give him permission, go ahead and explore. So I go upstairs. Half hour later, he comes up, says, Dad, come look what I did. I'm like, I'm not expecting anything. And I go down and I still have this file. He's created Percy from Thomas the Tank Engine, and it's recognizable. And the crazy thing is he's figured out tools I haven't shown him how to use yet to make this character. I'm like, okay, I'm going to show you how to download a photo. Here's how you set type. And then I can't get him off my computer because he's making all these train related things. So he's not only gone from, being solely in his world, he's crossed over into mine. And he's not only not just consuming content, he's making content. It's like, whew, right? So at this point, Margaret is getting her master's in special education at the University of Minnesota. We were up in living in Minneapolis at the time, Minneapolis area. And, I'm a whatever, highfalutin creative director. I was like looking for the big idea. And, a couple of weeks later, I'm like, hey, what if we took autistic students, matched them with a mentor who's involved in, the arts or design, gave them access to creative technologies, gave them, let them use their area of interest. At that point, it was called area perseveration, which is such a nice clinical term. And what kind of special ed support would we need? So Margaret and I kind of figured out the name Islands of Brilliance. I came right away, and we had this idea for this program called Islands of Brilliance. It took about 4 years to actually launch a pilot because I had been involved in for-profit startups and I had forgotten about the nonprofit experience with Labyrinth Company. So it was always like, how do you raise money? How do you like all that stuff? You got to have a board. But I was involved in the startup community in Milwaukee by then. We had moved back and it's like do a minimum viable product. So we did it. We were able to do the first workshop at Discovery World. They were kind enough to allow us to use a computer lab there, and we had seven students, seven mentors. We didn't know would designers want to do this. They're busy people. It's like it works with my kid and I don't know, but 20 people came to the first meetup. It was amazing, and that still happens. Like the generosity of people with their time and interest in this community, I think, just blows us away. And I know that you have seen that in your time with us too, is that they showed up. The first workshop was amazing. They loved working with the kids because they were like they had these geeky interests that they were experts on, and so did the mentors. So it was like they weren't that all that different. Creative people are kind of, unique as well. So it was like this perfect match. And then there was a second workshop where all the kids got there. Most of the kids got there early, went and found their mentor, and were working. And were like, wow, this works. So it incrementally it became our like side hustle, our part-time gig, all that to the point where late 2015, we both left our full-time jobs to dedicate ourselves to this, raise money, got good at writing grants and fundraising, always with the focus on the quality of the experience on the show. It was all about the show. All that other stuff, like we could figure that out, but if the experience for the students, the mentors, and the families was perfection, then everything would take care of itself. So it's grown now to here we are in 2024. It's 12 years almost, where what we have 14, 15 employees, 12 full-time, 3 part-time. You are helping us spread across the state of Wisconsin with the fellowship, which is a really exciting program. And it's been this journey and experience that we talk about joy all the time. It consistently delivers this sense of joy in, based in the creative process and the growth around that. And I think hopefully, all the listeners that, your involvement in theater and that process and the love of that process and the connectivity between human beings in that process, that is at the core of Islands of Brilliance.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing. I hope that folks who listen to this, if they have a background in theater and they have an idea for something in, the social entrepreneurship realm, the social impact realm, just know that you are uniquely qualified to get something new off the ground just by virtue of being a theater artist. And so I would love to hear from you both about how did the roots in theater. And this is beautiful because you both intrinsically said, Margaret said, yes, and Mark, you said, what if? And I think those are two huge philosophical pieces that get imbued in us as theater artists from, a young age. How does theater and what if and yes, and help you grow from one workshop to 15 staff members and roughly a dozen different programs that are going on with IOB?
I'm going to go back to that joy factor.
Yes.
And I remember, again, I'm going to go back to that I found such joy in performing, right? It was fulfilling on so many different levels, the exploration, all that stuff. What we have done, I think, is take that feeling that you get of accomplishment, right? That so many of our students are marginalized, in traditional environments, in a classroom, sit down, be quiet, don't move, don't talk. This is my classroom, not your classroom. Behave that there's sort of that mantra of like, you need to fit in to this environment, as opposed to an environment where, man, explore who you are. We welcome who you are. We celebrate who you are. And that's often the first time that students are sort of like, well, what is this? I can talk about Pokemon. And then each day we invite them up, say, man, show your Pokemon. That's so cool. What did you learn today? And sometimes what they learn is something didn't go right, right? Like just like in theater, like, oh, prop broke, right? How do you learn from that and grow from that? And then also celebrate that, hey, we learned a lot with that, as opposed to, oh, you made a mistake. It's a different process, it's a different way of looking at things, but also just in going back and saying, having a student reflect on how they learned and then celebrating that, even if it's like, hey, I learned how to bring in a picture of something. And we're like, that is so cool. How do you want to celebrate? And we're asking them, we're not telling them, we're not saying you need applause. We're like, what works for you? Right. And they're like, oh, well, I'm good. And we're like, okay, great. And for them, they're like, wait a minute. I'm so used to people just doing what they want to do as opposed to listening to my words. And again, that goes back to theater. We have to listen. If we're not listening to them, we're not respecting them. And I think when they get that over and over and over, suddenly by the final presentation, because most of the workshops run a series, they're like, they are standing up and they are proud. They know what to expect because we've rehearsed it, right? We've gone up every day and we practice answering these questions. Well, then we expand it a little bit more. We invite questions from the audience, but when you see them answer those questions, they're literally, I keep saying, they stand a little taller when they walk out that door because they know they've been heard and they've been celebrated. And quite often it's the first time that has ever happened for them. And there's such joy in that.
I also think there's this shared sense of ownership in theater that is unique and that we try to bring to what we do that you know, whether you're a lead or you're a supporting role, you're the director, you're in lighting, you're props, things like that. It takes all of those things to stage a show. And I always felt that there was this unique bond between everybody who is putting on a show, that everybody understands how important each of those contributions go to making a great performance. I think the other thing too, you know, when you talk about why not artists and actors and performers getting involved in social innovation, all of us who have been involved in theater know how horrible the first few rehearsals are. They are mistake ridden, right? And it's like, that is part of the process, right? And people, and I don't know, our culture is like, you know, you hear more now, like, oh, it's okay to fail. It's like, man, when you're doing a show, you're failing all the time at the first time. Like those initial like rehearsals are, God, or like when I'm going to give a talk, like a, you know, TEDx or something like that, I hate the initial because it's like it's riddled with mistakes. But that's a key component of growth and getting to the product and putting it on. I think being comfortable with that, and we're all kind of comfortable. We may not like it, but you understand, like, oh, you got to get through that icky period of, you know, people forget lines or all that stuff. Like, that's kind of like core to whether it's starting a nonprofit or starting a you know, social impact or a business. Like, that's core to it. It's like just being comfortable. It's like, yeah, this is going to suck for a bit, but we'll get through it and learn.
Absolutely. I think about when I was learning stage combat, my instructor, I would get really frustrated with myself. And my instructor would say, you have to give yourself permission to learn. Like, and I think it's maybe a cultural thing right now that, like, oh, you have to be good at something right away. But no one, I mean, it's very hard to be perfect at something right away. You need these safe spaces or brave spaces or however you want to categorize them where you can be authentic and like you can fail or make a mistake and it's not the end of the world, right? It's all information, right? And so instead of putting the judgment of, oh crap, I'm awful at Photoshop or whatnot. And I think you have assembled, and I think also a lot about casting. You know, they say 90% of directing is casting, right? And I am in awe of the cast you have assembled for Islands of Brilliance. Like,
it is a good cast. I love that you're referring to it that way. Yeah.
I mean, I think about Chris, who is our director of technology, and how much kindness he has as a human, and to see him interact with students, and the way he pushes them is such a lovely thing of a student wants to go, you know, a student is at A and wants to get to B. Chris isn't going to say, here's the path, here's the way to get to B. And I think it's a methodology thing throughout the organization of, okay, how do you want to get to B? How can we go with instead of, how can we be with people instead of at people?
Mm-hmm.
Right, which I think is a pretty theatrical thing too, baked into collaboration and problem solving a bit.
I'm not going to tell you how to read your lines. They're your lines.
No line readings. No line readings ever. Oh my. Well, we're laughing, so this is a great segue. We've already talked about the importance of joy a bit. We talk about joy a lot at Islands of Brilliance. And Mark, I love this goal of bringing ILB joy to as many places for an hour at a time as possible for 2024. It seems maybe a silly question, but what is the importance of joy? And then also, how can we encourage folks to experience autism and neurodivergence through a joyful lens instead of the, ah, I don't know what to do. Someone has just disclosed they're autistic. Are they a different person now? No. They're still cool. That's a rambly question. So joy in autism. Let's talk about it.
I'm going to let give it to Margaret at the beginning, because you've talked about the joy factor, I don't know, since the beginning. That was like the joy factor. So.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to my transfer from being a parent and an actress to being a coach for our son. to becoming a teacher. Throughout that, what I found is when I w and I and I I'm using the me, but what it really was is meant that I found the right script, right? When I was able to plant that seed that ended up connecting and working and flourishing and having that whatever that thing was, that skill, that whatever, when I saw that blossom and thrive, I found such joy because I could see that it wasn't about me. It was about finding that, going deep enough to find the thing that connected, right? So that I kind of carried that into my teaching. And I remember my very first teaching job. It was the very first person, the young man, about 5 years old, was autistic. It's the very first time the school had an autistic individual. And there was palpable fear from the teachers. And I'm coming in being a parent first and then a teacher, going, why are you afraid of this little 5-year-old? And to me, it was flipping that to getting to know this kid, finding those moments of connecting with him, and just seeing this is a tip. This is a 5-year-old kid, right? Don't treat this child any differently because he has autism. Find out what connects with him and then feed into that. And it was literally like taking the veil off of autism for the teachers because they're like, wait. He's just a 5-year-old kid. He just happens to have autism. So let's learn about what are, some of the things that we can do, strategies and things like that. But it was, for me, it was just like, raising the curtain. Don't be afraid of this because this kid is, you're looking at this kid as different. He just has autism. Don't be afraid of that. And then I was able to like give them a couple scripts to work with. Here's what I would do. But again, I'm not going to be in your classroom 100% of the time. So here's some tools I can give you that I know have worked with it. So when I would literally go in and model, just like this is a great way to interact with this child that works for this child. And then other students and teachers and staff can interact with this child in a way that's supportive and kind and loving. But you're also seeing this child as a child and not just as a child with autism. You're not defining the child by their autism. You're seeing them as a child. And then all of a sudden, gosh, next year we got a couple more kids and we got a couple more, so then all of a sudden, it's like it, but it was exciting how the teachers then who were like knowing, hey, they're going to be coming to my grade would reach out and like, I need to learn ahead of time. So we're able to dispel the fear and have a better understanding about how to connect and how to resonate, just the same way you would be like, hey, we're going to be doing, Shakespeare next year. Let's all learn how to speak well. It's a very similar process in that dispel the fear, embrace the qualities and uniqueness and joy that is within each child.
I think too, it's we've talked about special interest and spin. Really, what is that is a center of joy, right? And we all have those. What's like yours is drag, right? Mine is pizza and cooking. Margaret is wine or vanilla bean latte. We all have those things.
But it's renovating the house. Let's be serious. If I could
This
renovate
project.
the
Oh
house,
my
every
God.
room in the house, I would.
But when we look at neurodivergent individuals, autistic individuals, their areas, those centers of joy seem a little geeky and they might seem immature, right? So if somebody has, a 17-year-old son or daughter who's on the golf team, that's like fed and encouraged, and that's like, oh, absolutely, that's all they can talk about. If you have a 17-year-old son or daughter who's into Thomas or My Little Pony or Pokemon, that's like, I don't want to hear it. Like, that's not age appropriate or whatever. It's like, so our entire culture for these individuals like shuts down their area of joy. Think how you would feel about that. That's why when kids come to us, kids from 6 to 30, when they come to us, it's like, what, you're interested in My Little Pony? Let's go for it. Right? Spend the next 90 minutes creating, talking, all that. We boost like your area of joy is important to us because it's important to you, and they don't get that anywhere. Sometimes even in their own family. So to create that space where it's like, this is my space, it's my driving range if you want to use the golf analogy, right? It's their space to explore and be celebrated for that interest. And like, we're going to feed that. And guess what happens? Their confidence is boosted.
Because
Self-worth is boosted. All those like intrinsic things that everybody else experiences because their area of joy is more accepted by our culture. Like, so it's to me, it's like always, what's their area of joy? What's that special interest? Go there, ask them about it, because they'll tell you.
And I'm also going to add to the on the opposite end, right? As Mark mentioned, when you're told not to talk about your area of passion, your area of joy, the thing that you know makes you excited and motivated, when you're told to stop that, what does that do to who you feel as a person, who you are as a person, right? It tells you we don't value you, we don't respect you, we don't honor the things that are important to you. You don't matter. So that translates to mental health, depression, anxiety, increased behavior, right? So, like when I'm thinking in terms just from the lens of a special educator, when I don't understand the things that are motivating to my students and I tamp that down, I'm doing them a disservice. I'm not listening to them. But when I bring them up, when I celebrate that, when I let them learn through the things that matter to them and you see them thrive, that's joyful. If we look at the opposite, kind of look at where we're at as a society. We are struggling with mental health. We're struggling with anxiety and depression and things like that. So that's why people are like, oh yeah, you're that place that does, that feel good place. Yeah, we are. And boy, do we need it more now than ever. So I'm embracing that and I'm saying we need to go there because when we haven't been going there, look what we're seeing. Suicide
Well,
rates
there's
off the charts, right? I mean, we're like, no, we need to embrace joy. We need to embrace unique qualities and come together.
I mean the important statistics for the audience, and it might not 83% underemployment for autistic individuals, 70% or higher report mental health issues. Those are intrinsically linked. And everything we just talked about, that's why. If your interests are constantly belittled or even extinguished, what does that lead to? That's your identity, right? When we talk about identity.
Right. I will say, because I, you know, I, Kate and I, and Kate, because you get to work with her, but we are lucky enough to more often than not be that first point of contact for a parent or sometimes a self-advocate. And quite often, the question is, are you finally that place that understands my son or daughter? Are you finally that place that will welcome and embrace them? Right. And I keep saying, on top of that, we tend to be, because of who we are and because of our philosophy, that one thing that will get them out of the basement, off the couch, and out the door. And that is huge. If you have lived it and you are struggling to get your kid to put clothes on, right? And all of a sudden they find an environment where they're like, hey, man, that is so cool. Tell me more about Minecraft. Tell me more about Smash Brothers. And they're like, what? All of a sudden you got somebody who's willing to listen to you. Somebody's willing to go there with you. And suddenly you're willing to get off the couch. Because prior to then, you were not heard. You were invisible. We want to shine a light on you.
Yeah, I kind of just want like every autistic human ever to be able to like experience an IOP workshop because myself, I was diagnosed with autism at 34, I think. We're coming up on a 5 years of the diagnosis. And it was very interesting. It was like a little Keebler elf of a man who did the diagnosis.
Description.
And he said, he was like, I don't. I think this is an interesting like bookend parallel to like what you were told in terms of expectations and stuff. He was like, yeah, I don't, because I was halfway through a PhD program. He was like, I don't know how you've gotten this far without knowing this about yourself. And it's like, what? I don't know. What am I supposed to do with that? Like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like, thank you. Thank you. And so it's very profound. I think about, you're talking about Dr. Kate Siegman, who's our director of learning and outcomes. And one of my favorite spots to be in the world is in virtual Brilliant Breakfast Club on Friday mornings. And we're just talking, what were we talking? We're talking about self-regulation last week. One of the coolest conversations I've ever had was in that group talking about optimism versus pessimism. And like, I don't know that much about SpongeBob SquarePants, but there were other folks in that group who sure did. And being in workshops with Chris, being in BBC with Kate, like having experienced a lot of grad school, like these are grad school level, for whatever that means, conversations about character choices, character development, interactions. And I never feel, this isn't a question, but I don't care. Like I never feel more like myself than in that like 50-minute block. right? And I am just sitting at home being connected. And I wanted to shout out something that Mark, you said in, I think it was a Milwaukee Journal piece about mental health and the internet. And we have this perception of, oh my gosh, we got to get our kids off the internet. We got to, actually not so for some neurodivergent individuals. Like sometimes that online connection is what is accessible and what is that lifeline. Do y'all mind talking about that a little bit as we sort of come to the end of our conversation?
Well, I'm going to jump in because, Mark mentioned way early on when Harry was engaging in, YouTube and, commenting in the threads. I will say it was pretty easy as a parent, and he was younger because you could put on parental control. But as he got older and became, you have to start letting go, right? And then sometimes that led to him making choices where, again, I feared. Because I am not a comfortable social media person. I am not, I don't, my screen time is my spider solitaire procrastination. His screen time is, in a chat room or meeting people or saying, hey, I'm going to go to this train place. Are you guys going to be there? That raises, boy, the spidey sense on the back of my, like, who are those people? Do I trust them? So he, in some ways, we had to trust that he was making good choices. We had to coach and support in the process. But at some point in time, we had to let go. And what I will say is he has, we're going to call it the train posse, but he has his people. And he has developed a way of understanding how, developing that trust and listening to us in a way that worked for him. But I will tell you, he's traveled across the country and met these people, and they have just had the best time ever. And we want him to write a blog like The Autistic Traveler because he can book his hotel. He knows where to go. He scopes the restaurants. He knows, first the train, then the bus, then the plane. I mean, he's got it. And it's because he's motivated to meet his people and do his thing. And if we didn't trust him to make those choices on his own, again, like, oh, when it doesn't go well, if somebody's trolling you, here's what you have to do. Here's how you block it. But that has opened up a world to him that I never knew existed, but has allowed him to flourish.
I think too, just a bookend on Harry's story. Yes, he did go to college. He graduated from UW Milwaukee, where Margaret and I met, with honors from
He actually
Expo in
worked
the
at the gas
Arts.
house. He worked at the
Worked at the Gas House. It's like the circles and ripple effect of this story, like just keep going on and on. And he's employed. Margaret talked about how he travels with his train posse. And he just paid off his college loan, which to me is like the greatest accomplishment. Of all the things he's done, that is like wow, so it's really remarkable what he has accomplished in his own life, and this is a story of one to many. It was all about if it worked for Harry, could it work for other kids? And it is, and it's continue, that ripple effect more, and that's really what we're focused on is how many positive outcomes can we create through the use of joy for neurodivergent individuals.
I'm giving jazz hands right now, dear listeners, of the jazz hand moment. So as we wind down this conversation, we're recording this in late February. It's going to go live in mid-April, which is autism. Are we saying acceptance or awareness? Which do y'all prefer?
Action. We go action.
Action. Oh man, I like that even better. So if you're listening to this, you're probably listening to it during Autism Action Month. So what's next for Islands of Brilliance? And if folks are, I hope they feel moved to connect and learn more after hearing this conversation, where can they find you and all the good work that y'all are doing?
Islandsofbrilliance.org or islandsofbrilliance.org in my radio podcast
We need
language.
Margaret to do the
Right.
voiceover.
Sounds better with her voice. But you can find out about that. There are opportunities to become involved. Theater people are multi-talented, as we all know. We are always looking for mentors, and you can do it virtually. We have a lot of different virtual programming that's really interesting. So you can look at that and see our work. And we are constantly looking to grow the impact of what we do. We talked about the growth through the fellowship program, and that'll continue. So if you want to find out more and see some of the student stories, which are just incredible, that's the place to do it.
You might shed a few tears, but they're tears of joy.
And I encourage
Yes.
folks highly to check out social media as well, because you can see some of the student artwork and it's sincerely like Cartoon Network pitch level excellence. I'm thinking of Luke right now.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
How old is
Yes.
Luke? Is
11.
like 11.
11, and he,
Crazy.
you have to see it to believe
Yeah.
it. It's pretty incredible. So we're gonna model IOB vibes here. Mark and Margaret, how would you like to celebrate this podcast recording?
Man, I'm gonna finish up my vanilla bean latte.
Okay. Mark, how are you gonna celebrate?
How am I gonna celebrate? I actually wanted Margaret to sing the song from the Bacchae or the
Oh, you
train
ready?
for
You
the
gotta sing along with
Suzuki
me.
thing.
Okay, ready?
I don't remember the words, so you do it.
Wakare oshi muna tora no ne ni oki wa kibo oh no asabora ke nakuna kamome yo ano koni wa hare no de fune no kuro ke muri. You gotta like get it from your gut. That's not my pretty
We
voice. I'm gonna give
maybe
that a little.
we should have tested the audio levels on that.
Well, you couldn't have.
Remember that 40 years later, it just blows my mind.
You couldn't have known that that's how you wanted to celebrate when we began 40, 50 some minutes
I honestly, didn't
ago.
I sing it last night?
Yes, we were talking about it, and you started singing, like, how do you remember that? Oh my God.
Hey, I'm an actress. I remember my scripts.
I think that's a beautiful note to that's the period on the sentence. Mark and Margaret, thank you so much. Happy birthday again, Margaret. And
Thank you.
folks, go check out Islands of Brilliance. We're doing cool stuff.
Thanks, Woodson.
Thank you.
This was
So
a
much fun.
blast.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host and producer, Woodzik. This podcast is distributed by American Theater Magazine, and this episode was edited by Travis Rosemary Kerhart-Fischbach. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here next month for more interviews with artists and cultural trailblazers.